A Listener production.
Okay, are you recording? Are you recording?
Howdy, one and all. Welcome along to episode 16 of the Howie Games Artist Series, Part A, featuring surfer, singer, and all-round cool cat, Jack Johnson.
Right on, you guys. Thank you so much. Have a great time tonight. Aloha.
Now, when you meet and you get an email from Jack Johnson's people saying, Jack is good to come on your podcast for an hour, well, that is an email that gives you a real lift. I mean, a big lift, because Jack is everything that I'm not. But let's be honest, we'd like to be. He's a gun surfer, he lives in Hawaii, he's a wizard on the guitar, and his singing just oozes cool, absolute cool. Basically, to summarise, Jack travels the world, surfs, and performs his own music to adoring fans. What else is there in life? This is one of those podcasts where I've never met the guest before. Jack just pops up on Zoom out of nowhere, and you think, gee, I'm sitting in my studio in Bowen Heads, which is a fancy name for the spare bedroom, and here's Jack Johnson. Jack Johnson in Hawaii, a man that is on high rotation on my playlist, a bloke whose songs I have tried to learn on the guitar, rather badly, it must be said, and the best way to describe it is it's like a speed date, a sort of quick meet and greet, an introduction, and all this is often based around technical gear, which is not my strong point.
Plugged in here. I can either unplug it and use the computer, or I can keep this mic on and probably position it a little better.
From my end, Jack, if you could record your end of the conversation, that outstanding.
Microphone to my phone. You know, I'll just do it straight on the phone. Might be better. Sometimes if I got the level wrong, it might be a bit distorted or something.
Yeah, no, the phone's perfect. You don't have any headphones, do you? So I don't bleed onto your record.
Oh, yeah, sure. I can find something.
Sorry, thank you.
Okay. Again, don't forget, this is Jack Johnson. It's different to the athletes because in theory that's my area of expertise. But with people like Jack, I want them to come on the show because I'm in awe of their talent. Basically, I'm a fan.
Great. Let me just do a quick little test.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, you guys. We'll get to the chat and after we get all this technical stuff out of the way.
Yeah, you're right, mate.
Let's see. Testing one.
In this rather strange job that I'm in, I want to explain this the right way. It's a hard thing to explain, but I'll give it my best. Many people in this caper feel it's best to stay a little bit distant. Is that the right word? Yeah, I guess it is. Stay a little bit distant from the subject, that it's not appropriate to be a fan. But my wonderful wife, Erica, clever, clever lady, has always taught me, if you think something positive about someone, well, you should tell them. I love your hair, great dress, cool shoes, you're rocking it. So, in that respect, this is Jack Johnson. I love his music. I can remember listening to Jack's album On and On, driving from St Kilda down the coast in the old black ute with the CD player when I was going surfing. I remember those times like it was yesterday, and you'd all have songs that you hear and they take you back to fantastic parts of your life. I love that album, so I'm all about asking the proper questions, but letting the guests know, hey, Jack, love what you do.
One, two, one, two, one, two. How's that for you now?
That's great.
Yeah, perfect. Now, I'm recording my end. You're recording your end. So we should be all good, Jack.
Sounds good.
Just call me Howie, mate. Only my mum calls me Mark. It makes me nervous. So just call me Howie.
Sounds good. Thanks, Howie.
Are you good to go?
Then.
I feel good.
After all that, when you're starting to establish what's going on and you realise the guest, Jack, is as much of a dude as you had pictured in your head, then it is a beautiful, beautiful thing. And you pinch yourself and think, wow, how lucky am I? Jack released a new album early this year, Meet the Moonlight, his eighth studio album. It is magnificent, better than that. You can see Jack on his Aussie tour. It kicks off November the 29th in Perth, then goes to the Goldie, Brisbane, Sydney, and gets to Melbourne on December the 8th. You can get yourself tickets if you jump on Jack's website, jackjohnsonmusic.com, or wherever you get your tickets. Do yourself a favour, get there, see the great man in action.
Hey, thank you guys so much for singing along tonight.
Alrighty, enough from me. Thanks to John O'Keedles and the good folk at Universal Music Australia for making this episode happen. From surfing pipe to sell-out concerts, I could not be more stoked, as you've heard, to bring you a man with, for mine, the best job on the planet, Jack Hody Johnson. Enjoy. Well, this is a true treat. Welcome to the Howie Games Artist Series. A man that is a singer, a songwriter, an environmentalist, a movie producer and director, and a very chilled out customer as well. His name is Jack Johnson. He joins us on the show prior to his Australian tour, which is going to dominate, no doubt. Jack, nice to see you. How are you going?
Yeah, good to see you too.
Where are you coming in from?
Hawaii.
Hawaii.
Yeah.
Hawaii. Yeah. How's life in Hawaii at the moment? I guess it's just coming into your autumn, so still pretty flat.
You know, we had a little swell yesterday. It was the first real swell we've had, and it was kind of nice. It was, it got a bit packed. Everybody came from all over the island to surf with us, and it was fun waves. And yeah, this time of year is really nice because you get those first swells. Nobody remembers how to surf, so it's easy to get waves.
Where's your local break, and how far away is it? Are you on the North Shore?
I'm on the North Shore. That's about as specific as I tend to get because right, I don't okay, want people coming okay. to the spot I surf.
Well, maybe tell me where your favorite break is then rather than your local break.
Well, I always say Pipeline because it's so damn crowded anyways. So I'll just say Pipeline. Everybody go there. It truly was. I don't surf it anymore. I mean, I'll sneak out there if I'm at my mom's house and I see that the waves are good. Nobody's around. But it's so crowded and it's so heavy too, but there was a time in my life with no doubt that was my favorite wave. I mean, anybody who loves to surf and on that level, it's one of your favorite waves. Despite the crowds and all that, the wave itself, you know, it's pretty amazing.
It's such a fabled place. I've only been there when it's been dead flat and I think I actually had a swim there and there's no way I would have the ability to surf there. But tell me about the lineup and the respect you need to show to get a wave. Like, it's so fabled that the story's about surfing pipe and the respect you need to show so you don't get yourself in a spot of bother.
Yeah, yeah, that's, it's an interesting wave because believe it or not, you would be able to surf it. It breaks even when it's, you know, 2 feet. We used to surf it almost every day. And we kind of, even if it wasn't the best spot, we just ended up out there. And I think it was something about it. It's sometimes you had that hope that if it just picked up a little more, it might start to barrel. It kind of has this thing where it's kind of breaks like every other spot up until it gets, I don't know, about 4 feet. And then it starts to pitch a little and have, you know, the beginning of a barrel. And then it gets 5 feet and all of a sudden it's really hollow. And then from there on, it gets heavier and heavier. And it's, you're right about the lineup. It just depends. There's days where it's really playful out there when it's 4 feet or less. It's just people goofing around, having fun and trading waves and stuff. And then when it gets really good, you know, there's the respectable side of the respect of any place that you go and surf in the world. You should always not paddle out to the lineup. I mean, I travel a lot. And I never paddle right to the peak. I always kind of paddle out and I sit a little inside, check out whose spot, you know, who's surfing there every day. You can start to tell the people who know the takeoff spot and that kind of thing. And then you wait till it's your turn and that kind of thing. And so there's that side of it. And it's, unfortunately, it's such a crowded wave as so many people come to surf it that it's sometimes the people who truly surf there every day, it's hard to recognize who those are because then there's the days where all the cameras come out and all the pros are out and it's just like, it's a circus out there. It's ridiculous. It gets so crowded. And it's, so then there's fights and things just because I think it becomes more about egos and things like that than actual respect. You know, there's both sides of it. It gets all mixed up and that kind of a thing. But growing up, I mean, there was, when I was a kid, there was, Marvin Foster and Johnny Boy Gomes and, you know, Derek Ho and those type of people that were, you know, born and raised and grew up surfing the spot and the way they surfed it, we all just would watch and kind of admire the way they do it and try our best to emulate what they were doing.
I'm really pumped to have you on the show. I can recall 20 years ago, I can still recall where I was, and a mate rang me and he said, oh, you got to listen to this song. And I said, what's the song? A really musical type of character. He said, it's called Flake. It's by this bloke called Jack Johnson. And that was my beginning of my journey listening to your music. And it's been going on for 20 years. So when I was just talking to you and you were getting set up and you said you'd listened to a couple of episodes of the podcast, Jack, I reckon you've made my year. So I appreciate that. You listened to Kelly, I presume?
Yeah, I did. I listened to Kelly's. It was great. It's fun. We're such good friends from growing up. And he's a great conversationalist. He's really honest, you know, and you can hear him trying to be as honest as possible. You can also hear him thinking sometimes. He takes a long time because you can.
Yeah.
And as a close friend, I can sometimes hear when I hear him in an interview thinking about what he's willing to talk about and what he's not. And he's usually pretty willing to be honest with things. And but I really enjoyed listening because, you know, I know it's a sports-centered podcast and I'm actually a pretty competitive guy growing up, but I can't say that I know a lot of stats about different sports and things. But listening to Kelly's was good because I've got a lot of, I don't know, I got a lot of interesting takes on Kelly just from seeing him from a teenager all the way up until where he's at now. And it's always fun. We talk about it together a lot, actually.
Well, I was pumped that you'd listen to someone. I think you said you listened to Tame Impala as well, who's a very talented dude. Now, you're coming to Australia. So people need to go and watch Jack, and you can check out exactly where he is, jackjohnsonmusic.com. But I looked at the tour dates, and you start in the West, and then you go over to the Goldie and Brisbane and down to the Opera House, which it must be incredible, down here to Victoria where I am. Do you pack a surfboard? Because I was looking at the gaps between the shows, Jack, and it didn't look like there was much time to go to Margaret River when you're in Perth or the Superbank when you're on the Goldie, etc.
Yeah, no, I used to pack boards, and now luckily I kind of have friends in it each spot that'll loan me boards, and I'm not too picky when it comes to boards and stuff. And believe it or not, we do have time. Like when we're touring, we get to the point where we're pretty ready for the show, and sound check becomes optional. It's it's fun. We love doing sound check because we always try songs we haven't tried in a while, or kind of experiment around with covers and things. But if the waves are cranking, or if there's like one of those race cart tracks nearby, you know, then we'll go over there instead and like bring the kids and stuff. And we just toured through the South of America, and we did a lot of race carts, and it was pretty fun. But anyways, yeah. So if the surf's good, sound check's off, and then I can get there basically pretty close to the show and go ahead and jump on a stage. Luckily, people aren't really like coming to our shows to see if we're going to hit all the right chords, you know? So like if we miss a sound check, it's no big deal.
So when you come, I'm always fascinated by this, Jack. When you come to Australia, you know, you're a guy from Hawaii, from the other side of the world. I know it's a very small world, but when you're there in Kings Park in Perth or the Opera House in Sydney, and you go out in front of a audience that you ostensibly don't know, they know you, and you start, you know, one of your songs, Taylor or Banana Pancakes, whatever it may be, and the audience sings along to the lyrics that you've written because they mean something to you. What is that feeling like when strangers that you don't know start singing the words to your songs? It must be uplifting.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I mean, I think it's definitely given me the courage to do this, to even be able to perform the songs live. Because I can honestly tell you, I used to write songs. I never dreamed I was going to actually put them out to the world. I used to make these little tapes, and I'd share them to a few friends in after college, right around that time. And then when I got the opportunity to make the first album, it was a trip. And we had these pretty small goals of the amount we need to sell to pay off like the week we spent in the studio, and if we were going to try to keep doing it, you know, that kind of thing. And so when it just kind of hit this exponential growth, and it was just so wild how it all kind of started taking off. And when people started singing along at the concerts, man, that really made a huge difference to me, because it was, that became what the shows were all about. It was like coming together and trying to write these songs that were more or less full of love. You know what I mean? I mean, some are a little more cynical and social commentary, but in the end, I try to put a little love in every song or have it have a positive impact. And when people are singing those words back, and it's we're all doing it together, it's the thing that gives me the fuel to keep doing it.
When did you first hear one of your songs on the radio?
Well, let's see. There was a song I recorded with G Love and Special Sauce called Rodeo Clowns, and I was a huge fan of their music. It was a chance meeting. It was Surf that brought us together. He was he's a surfer himself, grew up on the East Coast of the States, and we had used some of his music in our surf movies. I used to make surf movies. I made one called Thicker Than Water, one called September Sessions. And we wanted to use some of his music, and we didn't have much of a budget. So we would send him stuff like leashes and traction pads and stuff like that, or like different swag, just t-shirts and stuff from our friends that were sponsored. And he was that cool that he was basically doing it just for free gear, you know? And so we had a chance to meet finally. And we went for a surf one day, and I had a guitar in the trunk, and my friend that was the friend in common, he knew, and we were about to leave, and he's like, hey, he's got a guitar in the trunk, he's hoping to jam. And I was so embarrassed, you know, I was like, no, it's fine, we don't need to. And Garrett was the nicest guy. He's like, oh, grab him, let's play some music. We played each other a couple of songs we've been working on, and it was kind of crazy, because I could tell he really dug this song, Rodeo Clowns, I'd showed him, and then we traded numbers, and that night he called me and said, hey, tomorrow would you want to come in and try to record that song you showed me? And at first I was just going to kind of show him the chords and the words and stuff. And then and let him use the song. And then I did like a guide track on it. And then we kind of did a couple takes. And next thing I knew, I got a call the next day saying they wanted to use it just how we recorded it. And so long story short, that was the song. It ended up on his album. And then it got on this station in San Diego called 91X. And they started playing it pretty often. And so when we were in that area, we'd kind of tune in and see, you know. And back then it could be like, people could call. So we had a lot of relatives in that area, and they'd all call in suggesting that they play the song. And so it was, so it started getting played pretty often. That was definitely like a big spark that kind of started the whole thing.
And what's it like when you hear one of your songs on the radio? Like now it's constant, but the first couple of times when, you know, you've described it, and we'll go back to the beginning of your musical and surf journey, but when you hear your song on the radio, how does it make you feel?
It's a trip. I mean, it's kind of like when it first comes on, you recognize it, but not even as being your own. You kind of like, for me, whether it's on the radio or sometimes like at the grocery market or you're like walking somewhere in a hotel or something, you hear it in the background. And usually you kind of like listen for a second. And I was like, I know this song. What is this? And then it takes a second. You identify it as your own. And the funny thing is, like, half the time I'll think, I know this song. I like this song. What is this? Other half, it's kind of like, what song is this? Like, I'm not sure. I like this. And then it's like, oh, shoot, this one of mine, you know? And it's like, it kind of like nagged you a little bit or something. But it's like 50-50. I usually like about half of them when I hear them off the radio.
So that first song, Radio Clown, for those that are into their surfing, did Kelly name his trick Radio Clown after that song? You mentioned Kelly Slater at the start. I presume he did.
Yeah, he did. Because it was something to do with a rodeo flip, I think, was the skate move. It was really similar.
Yeah.
And so he figured he was the first one to kind of pull one off, at least on camera or something. And so he got to name it. And so he called it the Rodeo Clown. That was pretty funny.
How cool.
He called me up and told me.
Back to Jack shortly. A quick thanks from me to you all for the love that you've all given Series 2 of the Artist Series. The download numbers have been incredible. I've been really surprised, truly. So thanks to you all for trying something new and coming on the journey with us. We are going to have a short break on the Artist Series now. Four more episodes, though, will still be coming your way shortly with some cracking guests. I'll keep you in the loop when they're about to drop. All right, let's get back to Jack. Going back to your early life on the North Shore, can you separate what came into your life first, surfing or music, or is it all mixed together as a young fella?
No, surfing quite a bit earlier. I came from a surfing family. Everybody, we'd all go out together. I got two older brothers, and my dad and my mom would get in the ocean quite a bit. And surfing was everything for us. It wasn't about competition. None of us really were that competitive with it. By the time I was a teenager, it was really starting to explode. Not just the pro surfing, but to actually have amateur competitions in every region. That wasn't really something that was around even during my brother's time, like in the 70s and early 80s. And then late 80s, early 90s, there was a lot more contests you could do. So I started doing more of those. But growing up, it was all surf, surf, surf. And then around the age of 14, I picked up an ukulele like quite a bit at school. They kind of, in the same way some places have the little recorders, like those flute things you put in your mouth to learn your scale. Like in Hawaii, it's just a ukulele. There's a ton of them at the school and stuff. And so you learn how to play a song or two on those. And so I had like maybe I knew a couple chords on the ukulele, and that probably got my fingers kind of ready for it. But around 14 is when I first picked up a guitar, probably started surfing. I mean, honestly, at 6 months, you know what I mean? Like I know how it is now because I've had my own kids. It's like you just start putting them on a board and holding them there when you surf and stuff. And then at some point they start standing up and holding your hand on the front of the board. And you kind of just, I can't remember starting. It's just something that was always there with the surf. And then, but I think my first board was like at 5 years old when I got like my own board and stuff. It was just my brother's board. I remember them giving it to me and thinking like, hey, hang on, that's Pete's board. That's just, and I think he just got big enough. He got a new board. So then I got my first board. And and then the music, around teenage years, then it became kind of I wouldn't say 50-50. Surf always, even now, I mean, surf comes first. I mean, besides when I'm on a tour and I got to show up for a show and things like that, then obviously that the show comes first. But if I'm at home, it's, you know, the music kind of, even if I'm recording a record, if the waves are really good, we just take that day off usually.
So let's be honest, you got the world's best job. You're playing music for a living and you're surfing. Let's explore the surf journey, then come back to the music journey. Do you remember your first barrel or not?
Yeah, believe it or not, I don't remember like all the first, but the barrel I do, because I was on the front of my dad's board. He'd taken me out, and and I remember we were on this wave, and it must have been at Engukai Beach Park, which is a sandbar, and I can remember the really light blue water because it was sand bottom that day. It kind of changes a lot here where I grew up. There's times where it's all reef, and then during part of the year, it all gets covered with sand, and the sandbars come, and it's a lot of fun for when you're a kid, especially because all of a sudden you can try to pull into barrels without worrying about the sharp reef. And I remember being on the front of my dad's board, and I can remember watching the face of the wave. I didn't know how to do it on my own yet, I don't think. And I remember seeing it get more and more, you know, starting to curl over me. And then at some point, looking down through the tunnel and being really deep in there and then just completely wiping out. And I can remember my dad grabbing my ankle underwater and like pulling me up and then getting me above water. And I was probably pretty freaked out, but it stuck with me. I can always remember that vision of that first barrel. I don't know how old I was a little guy.
How do you go with your kids now with that? How old are your children, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, no, it's okay. I got, 18, 16, and 13.
How did you go early doors when you want them to progress?
Yeah.
So you want them to be able to go from 1 foot to 2 foot, but then all of a sudden you get to 2.5 foot and you come off together and they go to the bottom and you pull them up and they're like, Dad, I'm not going out for another 3 months. How did you feel that progression as you went?
That's exactly right. You explained it perfect. There's times where every parent, you try your best to be like, I'm not going to push them, I'm not going to push them. But then there's certain days where they don't feel like going out and you just see like it's the best opportunity because it's so small and it's like a little day that's perfect to learn. And so you'd be, come on, just go get one wave with me. And they'll say, okay. And they come out with you. And then of course, then you pearl and you eat it and you put them back like three, you know, probably more like 3 weeks. That I'd never had too bad of one where I pushed them, but it is true. Like then they're like, I don't want to go. Like they won't go with you for like a couple of weeks. And it's funny. That's the conversation out here because Hawaii is a little different too, because you don't have a perfect opportunity to teach kids very often because the waves get really big.
Yeah.
And so you do have to kind of like figure out the little times and the windows and be careful not to push them. There's just so much weirdness around it now too, with it being, you know, it used to be a subculture. Even when I was a kid, it was kind of transitioning into a pop culture. And now there's just a lot of people hungry to have their kids be the next John Florence, you know.
Yeah.
It's interesting, our next Kelly Slater.
It's a competitive world. Let's talk about your competitive surfing. The 1992 Pipe Masters Trials. You're a good enough surfer to get to that point. At this stage, are you going down the path of possibly becoming a professional surfer?
You know, I think if I was real honest and I try to go back into the brain of me at 15 or 16 years old, I think there was a part of me that thought, like, maybe if I get lucky. I kind of knew. It's like, how do you say this without sounding like forced humility? At that age, I could see the difference because, you know, Kelly Slater, Rob Machado, Shane Dorian, Ross Williams, all those guys that went on to be on the pro tour.
Yep.
We were friends with all those guys. And if we were surfing waves that were head high or smaller, there was quite a big difference between the guys that you could say, like, you could list them, you know, there's like 10 guys around it that you could say those guys are going to be on the pro tour.
Got ya.
Then there was this other path that you could take, though. There were guys like Todd Chesser and Rock Little and people we looked up to a lot that were like the early guys kind of pushing big wave surfing. Because when the waves got overhead high, we just all grew up in it. And all of us were around this neighborhood, really. I mean, anybody who put their time in was really comfortable in big surf. I mean, I can remember I had like one winter where I was a better big wave surfer than Kelly. You know, when he first showed up, I can remember him starting to hang out with us and paddle out on some of the days where we kind of knew where the lineup was. We knew where the spot, the currents are so strong and there's so much things that kind of become, you know, just innate in you of knowing exactly where to paddle, even though the current's going to take you about 100 yards down the way, so that if you happen to get through the sandbar, then you'll get out through the rip at this one spot of pipe. Without, if you jump in about 25 yards too far to the right, that current's going to take you down. You're not going to hit that window where the rip is, and you'll end up pupukea doing the walk of shame and coming back all the way down the beach to try again.
The walk of shame. So when you're talking about that you're more comfortable in the bigger waves than Kelly at that point, what type of size, for we have a lot of surfers listening to that show, what type of size at that young, you know, you went to the Pipe Trials as a 17-year-old, the youngest ever. What type of size were you comfortably surfing at Pipe then?
Yeah, and I want to reiterate that I was only better at Kelly in big waves for like a month or two, maybe 6 months at the most.
Straight to him.
he had an exponential growth like nobody else. I swear, it was funny because we all thought, okay, at least he's that kid from Florida that don't know how to surf big waves or better than that. And by the second winter he was here, he was like already better than everybody at Big Waves too. He just was crazy. Anything he put his mind to. But, you know, we were pretty comfortable. The interesting thing about Pipeline, so I was kind of, we would go out at Waimea when it was like more like pinball days, not the huge days. And we'd go out to Big Sunset and kind of check it out. But really Pipeline was the spot we surfed every day. And anybody in the surf world kind of knows, there's really like Pipeline specialists. There's people that just spend their whole life surfing that one spot. You surf other things, but that's, some people make their living on just being a great pipe surfer. And that was kind of us. I mean, we were almost like in the first generation of teenagers kind of surfing it, because the surfboard, my older brothers are going to laugh at that because they were surfing it too. But the thing, I will say, they were on the wrong boards because there weren't the right boards yet. You know, it was like there was all these really long, everybody to paddle into the waves, you had to have such long boards to get the momentum up. But then that length of board on those really hollow waves, it was really hard to like get in and set your rail and get in the right spot. So anyways, like board design had changed just enough. When I look back, we were even on funny boards in the 90s. They were really long still, but they were coming down in size a little. Nowadays, like John and those guys, they'll ride like a 6'2" on days that we used to ride 7'4"s, you know, that's just because the volume has changed around. But the, so at that age, we were really comfortable to go out and big surf. And then anybody who knows pipe really well knows that it actually gets a little easier to surf, but it goes, it's like if you did a graph of it, you know, it gets more and more scary up to about like 8 to 10 feet.
Yep.
And then it starts doing this thing where it breaks on a whole second reef out on the outside. So when it gets really big, like 12 feet, you can actually take off on an easier takeoff further back, set yourself up, and then drop over this double up into the first reef, which is a big commitment, but it's a little easier to do if you know what you're doing. And so we used to kind of like when it would get really big and we'd go sit way out the back and surf second reef. I had friends, there's a couple guys like Sean Briley is one of them. My friend Jocelyn now, they're guys that not, or Sean Briley, a lot of people heard of, but my friend Jocelyn now, if you ask any of those guys, if you ask Kelly Slater, the Malloy brothers, Shane Dorian, he was the first like kind of teenage kid that was going out and just pulling in deeper than anybody. He was just taking out the back. And a little bit like, you know, he's a little nuts. I mean, he was pulling the things he shouldn't have, but he was kind of the one that all these other kids would look at and be like, oh, maybe we can sit over there. I didn't even know that was an option. You know, he was sitting so much deeper than the rest of us. And so he was one of my best friends growing up. And so as long as I sat a little towards the shoulder from Josh, I knew I was okay. I just never wanted to be deeper than Josh. And so anyways, yeah, we were pretty comfortable 16 or, you know, when it got pretty big at pipe, but then guys like Derek Ho would paddle out and they knew how to do it a lot better than what we were doing. It was just, at that age, you kind of don't have a certain part of your brain developed that's like the logic part, I guess, you know, so you're taking off on things you shouldn't.
I'll take your word for it. So when it goes wrong at pipe, and I've spent a lot of time in the last 48 hours reading and looking and searching about you, and there's a, I don't know what it was from, there's a quasi interview that Kelly's trying to do with you after it went wrong for you at pipe and you got your head bandaged up, you got a couple of teeth missing. what happened at pipe for you when it went wrong?
Yeah, so that the interview, maybe we'll get that, because it's always so, how it all went down is kind of a funny thing. So Kelly and I were surfing together. It didn't really matter. And I was kind of frustrated at the time it was him, because it ended up getting more attention than it should have just because he was out with me. But it just like, we were out like a million times we'd done before, right at dark. Sun had probably just set. It was getting pretty dark, but the waves were pretty good. It wasn't especially huge. It was just, pipe is always shallow. And it's, sometimes you push it a little more when it's not on the bigger side. So it was probably like 6 feet, you know, it was like, but what we call 6 feet. So it's kind of like after the wave breaks, it's more about maybe the inside of the barrel is about 6 feet in parameter, but the actual wave when it stands up might be closer to kind of double overhead. And, I pulled into this wave. And actually, I heard Kelly talking about it on your podcast when you guys were discussing wipeouts. And it's a real art. You know, the guys that are really comfortable in big surf are the ones that know how to get them. It's like the eject button in certain situations. So when you're in the barrel and you're traveling in the cylinder and you got the reef underneath you, you don't really need to. It's all muscle memory at some point. You don't have to think this through every time. But I guess if you analyze it, there's this shallow reef right there. And as you're going, and then you can tell you're not going to make it out of one of these things, you're best off getting away from your board, because what happens is if you keep trying to stay on your board past the point where you're going to make it, the bottom of the wave drops out. It's like an air compression thing. When a wave closes out, there's nowhere for the air to go. It kind of, the bottom opens up and you drop through. And if you're with your board, a lot of times it'll flip over and then you'll have the fins and all the rails and things to deal with. And so anyways, when that bottom drops out, you want to be away from your board. So as you dive off, you have two things to consider. You kind of want to go, you don't want to go straight down because you might go straight into the reef, and you don't want to go too high because then you're going to get pitched over the falls with the curling wave and go back onto the reef again. So there's a sweet spot. You kind of try to dive right into this little, you know, like a little angle on the wave that's probably about 15 degrees of a zone. And so I think I just misread it that day or something happened. And as I jumped off, I kind of went straight into where the wave had opened up. And I just remember waiting to feel water like I'd done so many times before, but instead I just went straight head into the reef. Oh. And just basically knocked me out to the point where I wasn't functioning. I was fully aware of what had happened and I was laying there underwater and thinking, I got to get these limbs working, I got to swim. But I wasn't too worried about it. I was also out of it enough to think like, oh, I'll just rest a little bit and take my time here. And just that, it was almost like the snoozing of a clock. The cycle happened a few times of trying to remind myself to swim and then just say, no, I'll just rest a little more. And then at some point, luckily, you know, I went to take a breath, but I breathed water in. So I think that just kind of kicked enough adrenaline in to wake me up, and I got to the surface. And so then I had to go get a bunch of stitches and three new fake teeth.
Hence the song, you said, drink the water, drink it down. This time I know I'm bound to spit it back up. I don't want this salty substitute. Just not going to do. I need some air if I'm going to live through. So you obviously wrote a song about the situation.
Yeah. It's an interesting song for me to hear because it's an early one. I think it's I don't know. Maybe songs are so different. You put them out, they're not yours anymore. You know, once you decide to share them. So if it means something to somebody else, that's great too. But I can remember trying to write that song and thinking of like, writing things that are relevant to me, but trying to think in metaphor of, when you feel smothered in life or unable to breathe or, that's like an early exercise in songs to me when I hear that one, but there's parts of it I like. And then it's always funny to hear songs you wrote when you're 18, 19 years old.
That is the end of Jack Johnson Part A. Turn the tape over and hit play, Part B.